Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 25th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the perceived war on women. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts as our panelists, and I'll introduce them only briefly, as their more complete bios were already provided to our audience. Fatima Goss-Graves is Vice President for Education and Employment at the National Women's Law Center, where she works to promote the rights of women and girls at school and in the workplace. She advocates and litigates core legal and policy issues relating to at-risk girls in school, including those that impact pregnant and parenting students, students in a hostile school climate, and students participating in athletics. Jennifer Becerris served as a commissioner on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She is a contributing columnist for the Boston Herald, and she's appeared on ABC News, CNN, Fox News, New England, Cable News, and National Public Radio. She also has a blog at redmom-bluestate.org. That's redmom-bluestate.org. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them, about 6 to 8 to 10 minutes or so, and then maybe a quick round of responses, and then we'll take questions from the audience. We'll check back in with you then. But with that, Ms. Goss-Graves, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I think that when we take a step back and think about where women are in the workplace and what sorts of policies impact their status in the workplace, I think that that's when you get to people talking about the war on women. And what I'd really like to talk about particularly is related to equal pay. About 6 years ago, after a jury found that Goodyear had paid Lilly Ledbetter far less than her male workers for doing the same job, the Supreme Court said that she had filed too late and that Lilly Ledbetter should have filed her discrimination charge within 6 months of her first discriminatory pay decision. Which is a rule that would have meant that an employee would somehow be forced to uncover the fact that she was making less, and that if an employer had hid its conduct, it can continue to pay her less unfairly. And this was something that I think there was a general outrage, something that made no sense, seemed really unfair. And so around doing something about the decision Ledbetter, really there was a rallying cry. And whether you agree that pay discrimination is a pervasive problem or not, or that pay discrimination is a significant contributor to the wage gap, whether you agree with that economic literature that says that, no one would have said that Lilly Ledbetter shouldn't be able to cover. And in fact, if you had a justice system where people could get remedies for pay discrimination, employers could who hide discrimination are permitted to pay them less, that seems unfair. So at that time, you had a really bipartisan response. It passed in both the House and the Senate, and there was this really nice moment where all of the women, Republican and Democrat, in the Senate went down together to vote in favor of the bill, and it was the issue that ended up being signed into law as the first substantive bill that the president signed into law in his first term. And it was an important law because it restored the ability to bring these types of pay discrimination claims at all. But it didn't move the ball forward. And when you talk about equal pay, which is an issue that really resonates with people, every time it is polled, people say, I want you to do something so that I am getting fair wages. So when you talk about equal pay, people want you to move the ball forward. So And that brings us to the Paycheck Fairness Act, and that is a bill that has been blocked time and time again from moving forward. It's a bill that would update what's now almost 50 years old, the Equal Pay Act, in many ways, and would work to provide incentives that are too often lacking so they can never get to the point of a lawsuit in the first place. And really important, it encourages conversations about wages between employers and employees so that you can be fired simply for asking your employer to do a pay study to see if you and or other women were generally underpaid. So, and in the past, Paycheck Fairness Act has been bipartisan, like Ledbetter. In fact, when it passed in the House, it received even more Republican votes than the Ledbetter Act did. And when we've conducted polling, we found that Democrats and Republicans and men, women, and really people around the country support improvements in the laws against pay discrimination. So I think it's an issue that people get, and it's an issue that in the past has been bipartisan. In the past, it's been something that we've been should have been able to be moved forward. The question is, what is preventing us from moving forward now? What, you know, what is the problem either with our politics or, you know, with the landscape in some way that prevents moving forward on things that are popular, that have historically been bipartisan, that would be important to women and important to women's economic security? And, you know, it is my hope that we will get past this, you know, longstanding blocking. And right now, the Paycheck Fairness Act has been introduced in both the House and the Senate and has really got the sort of public support. And the question is whether we're going to be able to move beyond where we have been. And that is sort of this blocking of issues that are so core to women's economic security.
Well, thank you very much. Let's hear now from Jennifer Braceras. Ms. Braceras.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here again to talk with Fatima about these issues. What I think is so interesting about discussions like these is when you get the two of us together on a panel, it all sounds so reasonable. And we can have reasonable policy debates about a particular piece of legislation, whether it's the Paycheck Fairness Act or the Lilly Ledbetter Act, and Fatima can say her view of why it's positive, and I could say my view as to why it's not advantageous. And it all sounds very reasonable. You walk out into the hallway afterwards, and there are microphones there on many occasions, and the next thing you know, it's being reported as anybody who's against this piece of legislation is engaged in a hostile war against women. And that's what I have my problem with. There are reasonable arguments in favor of the Paycheck Fairness Act. There are reasonable arguments against it. But somebody who opposes it is not anti-woman. From a substantive perspective, I would argue that the wage gap right now doesn't exist, or to the extent it does exist, it's minimal. The figure that people hear most often bandied about is that women earn only 70 cents on the dollar, 77 cents for every dollar earned by a man. Now, those are raw statistical averages of all full-time women and all full-time men. It does not take into account the jobs they have, the hours they work, the education they have. And when you control for those factors and when you compare similarly situated men with similarly situated women, you find that the pay gap virtually disappears. It's about 98 cents on the dollar. Now, that's not to say that there's not any discrimination out there or that that remaining 2 cents isn't caused by discrimination. In many cases, it very well could be. And that is why equal pay has been the law of the land for over 50 years. But the disparity, to the extent it exists, doesn't always favor men. A recent look at this issue by June O'Neill, who was at the Congressional Budget Office, found that never married women earn 108 cents on the dollar compared to never married men. And I don't see anybody out there complaining that this is evidence of discrimination against men. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But the fact of the matter is that men and women choose different educational paths. Men are more likely to select majors such as engineering or economics, whereas women, on average, are more likely to choose majors such as English and sociology. But even men and women who are in the same fields tend to accept different jobs after college. So more men than women decide to go into the private sector, whereas women often opt for jobs with government or nonprofit firms, which obviously pay less. A third factor that affects the wage disparities you see in the raw statistics has to do with choice, and that is that more female parents than male parents look for flexible work situations. Work at home, telecommuting, and the like. And then even among full-time workers in sort of non-flexible jobs where they're all in the office, women with children tend to put in fewer hours. So, for example, they will decline opportunities for out-of-town business trips that are going to keep them away from their children for too long, whereas men don't tend to turn down those opportunities. So there are a lot of reasons why the raw statistical data appears to show discrimination, but when you really parse the numbers, you see that it is not the case. But again, Fatima and I can argue about those statistics, and we can argue about what they mean. We can slice them, we can dice them. She has her interpretation, I have mine. I think that the real disturbing part, though, is the way that people on sort of my side of the aisle are characterized as hostile towards women. And I'm not accusing Fatima per se of making that claim, but certainly her ally organizations do that. The ACLU has an entire section of its website dedicated to the war on women. Emily's List has a website dedicated to the war on women. The Democratic Senatorial Committee, in their print and online materials, accuses the Republicans of waging an assault on women. And I think that this rhetoric is actually harmful to it's harmful to our public discourse because it creates anger where there shouldn't be, and it creates fear where there shouldn't be, where there should really just be reason to debate. I think that the war on women narrative is based on two assumptions, both of which, when you really look at them, are fairly absurd. The first is the notion that American women are socially, economically, and politically disadvantaged. And the second false assumption is the assumption that one party, the Republican Party, wants to keep it that way, that either they have a callous disregard for the plight of women or that they're conspiring to take away our rights or otherwise keep us down. So I just want to quickly address the second assumption first. The notion that any political party would be hostile to half of the electorate is really just silly. The Republican Party isn't a suicide pact. Even if it were completely controlled by men who had no interest in women's issues, the mere fact that they have to get elected by women as well as men would require them to take our views into consideration, and so they do. But putting that aside, the fact of the matter is that the Republican Party is populated by many women. And it is not just men who hold the views that are regarded as hostile to women. It's many women who hold those views, like myself, like many of the women at the Independent Women's Forum and the Republican Women's Caucus. And there are a lot of conservative and Republican women that hold these views. So the notion that, you know, Republican women are somehow advocating policies that are against their interest as a group, I think is unfounded. But going back to the first assumption that life is a struggle for American women and that they're somehow behind men economically, socially, and politically. I just think that, you know, even a quick internet search will show that that's just patently false. American women are better off than women anywhere else in the world today. And domestically, as a group, women collectively are better off than men. Academically, girls get equal or better grades than boys almost all the way along from kindergarten up through college in any discipline. They enroll in college in higher rates, higher numbers than men. They graduate from college in higher numbers than men. It's gotten to the point that many selective schools, Williams, Holy Cross, Amherst, some of the top schools in the country, are so unbalanced that they have a lower criteria for admission for men than they do for women. This is not always something that's said publicly, but, you know, bend the ear of an admissions officer for more than 10 minutes and you'll find out that this is true. Often, you know, my colleagues in the feminist movement will point to the STEM disciplines and science, technology, engineering, math, and they'll say, well, what about the disparity of women in those fields? Isn't that a result of discrimination? Well, I would argue that it's not. Like many of these things, I would argue that it's the result of choice. When you look at the data, you'll see that men and women earned similar grades to men, if not better, in math and science. So they're not doing poorly. But what the data also shows you is those same women also do better than men on tests of verbal ability. And so where men might be strong in science and math, women are often strong in more than one field, in many disciplines, and therefore they have more choices. So as a result, many women who are strong in science and math choose for a variety of personal reasons to go into other fields. And that was a study that came out just recently in the Journal of Psychology of Women Quarterly. So women are doing very well academically. Professionally, women hold more than half of all managerial and professional positions. More and more often, we see women as the sole breadwinners or the primary breadwinners of their families. As I said at the beginning of my remarks, similarly situated women make more money than their male counterparts. What you do see is a gap at the very top of the pyramid in CEO positions, law firm partners. Some people call it a leadership gap in the corporate world. And that is true, but I'm not sure that that is anything that the law can do something about, because very often you have women that self-select out of those positions. And we can talk about that more in the question and answer period as to why that is, and whether it's something that society should address or should leave alone. So there are disparities in certain places. I'm not denying the disparities exist. I'm simply arguing that in 2013, in a country that has civil rights protections in place for women and enforcement mechanisms in place for women, most of these disparities are the result of choice. And while we might need some tinkering around the margins with our civil rights laws, they're basically fine the way they are for women.
Thank you very much. I do want to get to audience questions, but before we do that, why don't we give Fatima Goss-Graves a chance to respond to some of what Jennifer Braceras has said.
Thank you. You know, I think here's probably where Jennifer and I agree. I think we probably both agree that there should be strong civil rights laws in place. We probably disagree on whether the existing laws are doing the job. But I did want to clarify a few things that she said, just so that there isn't confusion among the callers, because I do think that there's no question that women have made progress over the last 50 years since Congress first said you couldn't pay unequal wages to people in the same job. The wage gap has overall closed by 18% in that time. But it is also true that you cannot stop and say that there isn't additional work to do. In fact,
Jennifer was talking about how well single women, for example, are doing. Well, if you look at single women who have children, and their wages are especially important because they are the primary breadwinners, for sure, over a quarter of those families were poor. And 2.5 million working single mother families were on the edge of poverty. So I want to make sure that we are talking about all women. And I also think it's important to note that the studies that have tried to explain away the wage gap or say the wage gap doesn't exist, they've never been able to do it. You know, I think the study that Jennifer may have been talking about was the one that compared young urban single women to young urban single men and found that for that in particular cities that there wasn't a wage gap in those cities because the women had higher levels of education. I'm assuming that's the study she's talking about, because if you're comparing single men overall to single women overall, there certainly is a big gap between the women.
I'm comparing never married women to never married men, and the data, which I have not looked at the underlying
right,
data
there's a,
myself.
It's 72.9% when you look at the wage gap of single of never married women with no children to never married men.
Well, I'd refer you. I would refer the callers, if they want to verify this themselves, to June O'Neill's excellent book on this topic, where she has a chart that talks about this very clearly, and callers can look at it themselves. But again, as you said,
well, according to the 2012 most recent calculations that we've done, that's what the overall wage gap is for never married women without children compared to never married men. But in any event, the point that I am trying to make, which I think is a larger and more important point, it's that there have been a number of efforts to try to explain away the fact of the wage gap. And I think what's really important is to think about what are the contributors that to the wage gap, some of which I think Jennifer tried to touch on. So some of it is employers paying women less for the same work in the same job. And you may see cases where somehow people detect that they are being paid less, and then they are able to challenge that and correct it, although it's very hard to detect that because, in truth, whether an employer is paying someone less, that information is held pretty much with the employer and can be difficult for an employee to figure out. Some of it is that women receive fewer promotion opportunities. Now, again, you may see challenges in court for women who've had unfair promotion opportunities. Some of it is that women are more likely to be concentrated in jobs that are lower paying, traditionally women's jobs, jobs that I think in part are lower paying precisely because they've been traditionally been done by women, and that they haven't broken into some higher paying fields at every level of education. And I think, you know, there has been a lot of focus on STEM in part because the country has been focused a lot on STEM as growth opportunities, as important focus for our country in terms of its economic kinetic competitiveness worldwide. But even at sort of the higher wage vocational programs, there are many areas where women haven't fully broken into. And then some of the things have been, you know, what people have coined the motherhood penalty, the impact of women's greater responsibilities for caregiving, and the inadequate responses in some cases for employers. And what's interesting is that the studies have shown is that, in truth, that fathers end up getting a pay raise, whereas women who are mothers end up making less than fathers and women without children. And some of that, you know, relates to things that where there are smart policy solutions out there. So I don't think anyone is saying that the 77 cent statistic, you know, is an example only of pay discrimination in the same job, although I would say that that's a piece of it, and that the studies that have tried to explain it away haven't been able to do it, and the cases that have been out there suggest that, in fact, pay discrimination continues to exist. But I think what's more important is that it's a problem that is multifaceted, and it requires multifaceted solutions. And I think probably the thing to do is to sort of, you know, acknowledge that there is an issue and then think about what are the best policy solutions that might help move things forward.
So
I do want to get to audience questions, but Jennifer, why don't you take just a quick minute, if you could, and then, and then we'll turn to the audience for your questions.
My problem with the 77-cent figure is that it's disingenuous, and it's used as a piece of political propaganda. People walk around with buttons on it. Teenage girls are told about it in high school without actually parsing the data. And I agree that you can slice it and dice it different ways and come up with different analyses of the data. However, the claim that is usually made is not a claim that compares apples to apples. And when you talk about the salaries of never married men and never married women, it is irrelevant to say that a never married paralegal makes less than a never married partner at a law firm. The fact of the matter is that the career choices, the education, the hours worked, the job held, these all make a difference. So I apologize if I misspoke before and said, described the wage gap of all never married women to all never married men. What I intended to say was similarly situated men and women. And that wage gap does exist and it favors women. But putting that aside, I think one place that Fatima and I could certainly agree is that regardless of whether you're male and female, I think the biggest challenge to the next generation is balancing work and family. And if you're a parent, encouraging or finding a workplace that has some degree of flexibility and doesn't penalize you for trying to raise a family and earn a living at the same time. And to that point, I would highlight the recent decision by, was it the Yahoo CEO? The new Yahoo CEO, who's a woman and much heralded in her field. She recently came out and said that there will be no more telecommuting at Yahoo and that she wants boots on the ground at the corporate office every day. And that caused a lot of outrage among women's groups, rightly so, I believe, because if there's one thing that helps parents in this day and age, it's the ability to telecommute and it's the improvement of technology. So we need to work together, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, men and women, to encourage workplaces to allow for flexibility, telecommuting, and the like, so that the primary caregivers of children, whether they be men or women, do have equal opportunity, you know, to show what they can do. So I think that's an area where we can come together.
Thank you very much to both of you for those thoughtful remarks to get us started here. Let's try and get the audience involved now. So in a moment, you should all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Hold on one moment, please. So once again, we have quite a few people on the line. If you have a question, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have two caller questions to get us started here. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. As a guy who's friendly to women, what I note today is that most of this discussion has been about a higher skilled jobs, higher skilled people. What I find in looking across the landscape is the remaining problem is primarily at the lower level of socioeconomic status. And that's where most of the work needs to be done. However, I don't see civil rights laws as the solution. I consider them unconstitutional. And I propose that the best solution for this lower rungs of the socioeconomic ladder would be to put kids into military-style boarding schools and keep them the genders separated for the first 21 years until they have enough maturity to make intelligent decisions about things like having sex and giving birth. How do you feel about that?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but let me start by saying this. Number one, I agree with you that the employment problem and the stagnant wage problem is greatest in the lower classes, and that's certainly something that needs to be addressed. In terms of the wage gap, though, I do believe it's greatest at the highest levels, and conservatives and liberals will give you different reasons as to why that's so. Not to put words in anyone else's mouth, but I think that liberals would argue it's because of discrimination. Conservatives would argue it's because of the flexibility that those jobs provide. It tends to be that more women take advantage of that and end up putting in fewer hours for whatever societal reasons there may be. One interesting thing is that a study recently came out that ranks the states in terms of pay equity. And Massachusetts, which is ordinarily thought of as a bastion of liberalism and had one of the first equal pay laws in the country, was rated 37th among the 50 states in terms of the pay gap. Now, why is that the case? Well, it turns out it's because Massachusetts has a higher percentage of highly educated women and highly educated citizens generally than most other states. And so you're seeing an extended gap in the upper classes because the upper echelon jobs allow for more choice within the job as far as what you take on, whereas a factory worker on an assembly line, the man and the woman standing next to each other do the exact same task every day and therefore must be and are paid, you know, for the most part, the same amount. So there's more discretion in setting salaries at the higher level, and there's more flexibility, and that's why you see that.
Fatima Goss-Graves, do you want to weigh in on this point?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. We've got one caller question right now, actually two now, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Rod Sullivan from Florida Coastal School of Law, and the question is really for both of the speakers. In 2009, Betsy Stevenson published a study called The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness in the National Bureau of Economic Research, which has shown that since 1972, female happiness has consistently declined while male happiness has consistently increased. Do you think that there should be an opportunity here to reevaluate whether or not the goals of equal opportunity, equal pay, and equal employment may in fact be contributing to higher levels of female unhappiness, or are we on the right path and it just needs to be fine-tweaked and all of a sudden women will be happier?
This is Fatima. I am not familiar with that study, but I am familiar with studies that have talked about the fact that men and women are working more hours, and men and women are putting in, you know, if you could see me, I would have it in quotes, but more work at home as well, so that they are spending more time doing housekeeping, spending time with their families, and spending more time, and I could imagine that there is some thing tied to burning it at both ends. What I would say is that, you know, I guess you could raise the question of if women were being paid fairly at all times. And when I say being paid fairly, I mean paid what they're worth in the same job, being paid what they should be being paid, and even in lower paying jobs. You know, women make up two-thirds of adult minimum wage workers, for example. And so if there were increases in the minimum wage, that would raise the floor for all. So I could imagine that having more financial flexibility would assist in the overall problem of having to spend more hours working outside of the home and the additional hours that people are spending investing inside the home.
Well, it's never been my experience that more money leads to more happiness, but can we hear what the other speaker has to say?
Like Fatima, I'm not familiar with the study. I think it would be an interesting read. I'd like to take a look at it. And I'm always a little dubious of economists that try to quantify happiness. But I would agree with Fatima that, you know, burning it at both ends can lead to stress, which can then lead to unhappiness. And I will say, just from my own experience and anecdotally, and it does still seem to be the case that the majority of the housework and the child rearing in our society still falls to women, even though men are doing much, much more than they ever did. My husband is completely hands-on, and I don't think I had a complete conversation with my father until I was old enough to read the New York Times. So, you know, things have definitely changed, and men are doing a lot more than they used to, too. But I do think that women are trying to have it all. Maybe you could even argue we're sold a bill of goods about the ability to have it all, because nobody can. And sometimes happiness is correlated with your expectations. So if you expect that you are going to be able to be a hands-on mom and CEO of a corporation and have a happy marriage and lots of friends and a great social life and time for the great outdoors, and you're finding that you're not able to actually do all of that in a 24-hour day or 365-day year, then I would imagine that you might be unhappy if you had expected that that was what life held for you. So I think maybe expectations for everybody need to be reset.
Okay, well, thanks for your insight for both of you.
We've got a couple more questions pending, and we'll get to those momentarily. Let me make a programming announcement. Tomorrow, Friday, we do have another Teleform call on our schedule. We'll be discussing Missouri versus McNeely, which is the Supreme Court case concerning a non-consensual blood draw for alcohol. That'll be tomorrow, Friday, at 1 p.m. at the same number, tomorrow at 1 p.m. We've got three questions pending now, so let's go to our next caller.
I'm just finding how difficult it is in general to convince people through the use of statistics, let alone to form policy around it, because it does depend on how you suss it out. You know, people are much more persuaded by their own personal experience in life, you know, not being completely immune from political correctness. I've been flummoxed over 20 years in the workplace how free people are of saying that they don't want to work for a woman boss, or they've had terrible women bosses, or, you know, women bosses are so tough to work with. And it goes across the political spectrum, across the ideological spectrum, across the gender spectrum. It seems to be something that is not an uncommon, although impolite, judgment. I'm just wondering, in terms of inequality in the workplace, inequality in pay, inequality in promotion, the two speakers, what's your own experience with your own careers, the women you've worked with, the women you've come across that you've gotten to know, in terms of do the statistics, do your own beliefs bear out in your own personal careers and your own personal observations?
Well, the one thing that, again, this is anecdotal and not at all statistical, that I think is worth sharing is that, in part because of the work I do, I have had a number of people who have come to me because they have accidentally found out that they've been being paid less than their coworkers, and have sort of said, I never thought that this could or would happen to me. I have a lot of education, I'm a hard worker, how is it that I could be paid a lower salary? In a number of cases, they were able to really work it out with the employer, and what happened is what you would expect to happen under the laws, and that the employer corrected it when it was pointed out. But a bigger problem was noted is that these people all found out accidentally, you know, through a casual conversation. And that's no way to enforce the civil rights laws, and it's no way to ensure that people are being paid fairly on the job. And in fact, in some workspaces, it's illegal to, not illegal, but it is prohibited to talk about your own wages or the wages of your coworkers. So, I mean, it's a real concern that you have this sort of ad hoc accidental enforcement of what is such a core civil rights principle.
Jennifer Braceras, anything on this point?
Yeah, I mean, to the caller's point about female bosses, I've had both male and female mentors and bosses. I personally have not, I mean, I've experienced differences, but not gender differences in the way I was mentored. I've heard people say the things that you describe about female bosses. I do think that the times I've heard remarks like that, it has been, I've actually only heard it from other women, from female subordinates, and it's almost always been about women of a particular generation, the generation that didn't try to have it all, the generation that went into the workforce and put aside childbearing and childrearing for a while in order to have their careers. And there seemed to be a lack of understanding among some women in that generation of what it was that younger women, 40 and below, are now trying to do, and a lack of understanding between the generations, more of a generation gap than anything else. Again, I haven't experienced that. I've had female friends tell me they've had problems with certain female bosses because of that. But I think as time goes on, that's changing, because people in my generation and younger than me are becoming the bosses, and I think they have a little more compassion for the work-life balance.
We've got three questions pending at this point. If you would like to add yourself to the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hi, my name is Deirdre Bowling Lewis. My question really plays off of the last caller's question, and it's going to be couched more of a statement. But in my experience, what I have found, and I've worked all over the country, and I've worked for men and I've worked for women, and what I have found is that I agree with Jennifer. Women do make different choices, and in the current environment, those choices are affecting how much they may or may not make. But I've always seen it as that actually being the point of the discrimination against women, because the business world that we all work in is really designed, it was designed by men, not by women. And I think at this day and age, we all understand that men and women have different driving forces in our lives, different things that make us happy, different things that we want out of life. And I think that what I feel is that the discrimination kind of lies within that difference, because you're asking women who have a different idea of what they want and how their day should look to fit into a model that's been designed, you know, decades ago by men. The world is changing, and women are becoming bosses. And in my experience, when you work for a quote-unquote younger generation woman, you have a business environment that is really designed toward what makes women happy. And I think that women are incredibly productive in those environments. I think that we're paid well in those environments. I think that we you know, you can't have everything, but what you have to sacrifice on a daily basis is a little bit easier to swallow. I was just wondering if the speakers could comment on that.
I think you're probably right that, you know, our business structures were originally designed by men and not just by men, but by a different generation and with a different set of expectations. But when you have female CEOs coming in and putting the kibosh on telecommuting, it's not exactly helping.
You know, I agree with you, but I happen to be in the Bay Area, and my understanding is that kibosh was because, you know, a lot of companies have some concerns over telecommuting. It was a great idea when it first started, but now some companies are worried that people aren't really being as productive as they need to be.
Sure.
And in particular,
sure, and I understand that. And companies need to take control of that. And, you know, you can say there are different ways to do that. I mean, there are ways to count hours of productivity. There are ways to measure productivity. You can, you know, I understand the need for collaborative work time face-to-face, that cross-pollination of ideas that doesn't necessarily occur when you're all working in atomized, you know, homes or apartments around the city. I totally understand that and get that. But the draconian nature of the everybody will be in the office every day policy, I think, did strike a lot of working parents as a setback.
I agree with you. I agree.
Fatima Gosgraves, do you have a response here, or should we go to the next question?
Well, the only thing that I think would be good to know is I think the studies have been showing that both men and women have been seeking different types of work arrangements, and that I think employers are going to have to respond to this request from both men and women.
All right. We've got two more questions pending at this point. Let's go to our next caller.
It's David Emerson in Berkeley, California. My question has to do with the presumptions and burdens that come to bear in the analysis of some of these unexplained disparities between in the workplace between men and women. And I'd like to get the participants' point of view on when, in the case that there is a disparity and we're looking at the data and we can explain part of it away, but we end up with a component of it, which is we just don't know what the source of this disparity is. Where should rightly be the presumption? Should there be a presumption of discrimination? We trigger a civil rights remedy? And who bears the burden of proof at that point?
Well, this is Fatima. I mean, it's not really so if you're looking in a single workplace and an employer does a study that shows that systemically that it has been paying its female employees less than its male employees, even when you control for a range of factors, the sort of factors that Jennifer has been raising, like the sort of job that people are doing, like the hours worked, you know, no matter the factors that they control for. And I'll say that a number of employers have pretty sophisticated systems that allow them to put in place those controls, and they still find a disparity, and they're not able to explain it away. And it may be that along the way that their managers have been providing higher starting salaries for their male employees and promoting them at higher rates and providing them with more raises and razors of greater amounts. So then the question for you as an employer is, what do you do from there where you have found that you've been systematically paying your female employees less? And my recommendation for the employer would be to correct that problem. You know, if you're just talking about overall the economic studies that have tried to look at it based on the data that they've had and found that you can't explain away the wage gap, of course, our civil rights enforcement agencies, based on that information, wouldn't be able to sort of go in and do any sort of enforcement action. But what I think that it suggests is that there's a problem that needs attention, and that it may be that some of these pay disparities are really pay discrimination.
Well, this is Jennifer Brasaris. In terms of where the burden of proof should fall in terms of the law, I think it's an interesting question because a lot of our debates now about civil rights law generally, but in particular those that affect women and equal pay, they're not about whether or not there should be equal rights laws or whether or not men and women should be treated equally. The debates that people like Fatima and I have are about how those laws should be enforced, what burdens of proof should apply, what statutes of limitations should apply, and generally, you know, technically, how do we achieve a goal that I think we both want to achieve? And those are policy discussions and that are left to the legislature to decide. Now, the problem I have is twofold. The first is when Congress comes up with a solution as to how these claims should be adjudicated, and somebody doesn't like it and they take it to court and, you know, the Supreme Court or any one of the lower courts decides, no, Congress wanted it to be this way, and the complaining party who doesn't like how it is then holds a press conference and says, you know, this is an egregious violation of civil rights and the Supreme Court is hostile to women and we need more women on the court. And, you know, I look at the Ledbetter case, actually, as a case where the process worked perfectly, right? The case went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said Congress intended it to be this way. People didn't like that interpretation, and or Congress didn't like that interpretation, and they changed the law. That's how it's supposed to work, right? It's not necessarily an act of sexism by the court to say that this is what Congress intended. So I think that our discourse surrounding civil rights law can be really corrosive. And at the same time, our political discourse about these issues can be really corrosive. I could probably get in a room with Fatima, and we could craft a civil rights bill and come to some compromises on whatever the issue is. Let's say we didn't have any civil rights laws and we were inventing them all out of whole cloth. I'm sure that Fatima and I are two people of goodwill, and we could come up with something that we both were really proud of. But what makes it really hard is when you're trying to negotiate about laws with people who are telling you that you're hostile towards women and basically painting you as the, you know, next incarnation of Adolf Hitler. That's not helpful, and that's politically where we are. It's where we were in the last election. The last election on both the national and many local levels was run on a narrative of a Republican war on women. Unfortunately, in many cases, it worked. There are a lot of young women out there who believe that the Republican Party is waging war on women. And I think the Republicans have a lot of work to do to correct that misimpression. But I think the details of burdens of proof and statutes of limitations, and these are all things that reasonable people can come up with a balance of equities and a solution on. But the name calling is out of control.
I think we have time for a final question.
The name calling is not out of control by me. I'm not.
I wasn't accusing you personally, but one only needs to go on to the website of Emily's List or the ACLU or do a quick search and
I don't
find
know that I'd even
many,
accuse that. But what I will.
Well, there is. I mean, you can go on right now, but there are any number of liberals who have accused Republicans of assaulting women's rights and waging a war on women. And we see the posters, we see the bumper stickers. I see them every day up here in Massachusetts as I drive around. And the slogan is there, the narrative is there. I'm not saying that you were a major proponent of it, but it is certainly there. It was used by the left against Mitt Romney and any number of Republican candidates, and
so in any event, make my point that, you know, when people are putting forth policies that go to the core of women's economic security, the core of their ability to have sort of basic essential health care, things of that nature. I think it does get very personal. I think it's personal for individuals. I think it's personal for organizations. I think it's unfortunate that too often things that used to be really reasonable things, things that everyone would agree on, not all that controversial, have been repainted and recasted in lights that aren't productive. It was shameful that it took so long for Congress to finally reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act, for example. And I think that that was always something that had been very bipartisan, something that people really would get behind typically in that. And the fact that it had been held up and there were these huge efforts to water it down were really unfortunate. Fortunately, and I think the Violence Against Women Act lesson is an important one, eventually I think what the people wanted got through and it got done. And so it did take hard work and you had to sort of get past this sort of vitriol that was out there about it, but it was possible to do, and it was possible.
But see, again, that makes my point right there. I mean, it's not necessarily vitriol to be against a piece of legislation. Now, you know, nobody's for violent. Wait, let me finish.
That
nobody's
out there, so I just don't want you to mischaracterize what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm speaking generally about two sides of a debate, and with respect to the Violence Against Women Act, nobody wants to be opposed to something that's called the Violence Against Women Act. But the devil is often in the details, and as you know, things are often tacked on to these bills that involve massive amounts of funding for this group or the other group. And there are many reasons why one might be against a piece of legislation called the Violence Against Women Act that have nothing to do with your position on actually violence against women, which we are all against, right? So the notion that somebody who opposes that bill or any other bill with a pretty sounding name is therefore against women, it's unfair, and it's not taking them at their word or at their, you know, there has to be a level of trust between politicians and between interest groups. There has to be a level of understanding, at least, that, you know, we all are out for the common good, and we might have different ways of trying to get there. As soon as you start calling, not you personally, but as soon as one side starts calling their opponent vitriolic or hateful against women, the whole thing breaks down, and it's not good for our polity in the long run.
All right, let's try and get this final question in. I'm going to ask the caller to be brief if possible.
Yeah, Jim Markowski up in New York. The underlying premise of this war against women is that presumably all men are sinister and evil motives, which already I think is misguided because you're basing decisions on assumptions of people's motives. And the reality is, that, as I told my kids since they were little, life isn't fair. The sooner you learn it, the better off you'll be. You're trying to micromanage fairness with a myriad of different factors and statistics that can be manipulated in any which way. It's not fair that Dennis Rodman, who by his own admission would be cleaning toilets if it weren't for the NBA, gets paid tens of millions of dollars, and I don't get paid that. I mean, you could point out all sorts of things that are unfair in life, and to try to legislate away complicated items that are perceived to be unfair and predicated that on ascribing evil motives to the other people who are presumably being accused of being unfair borders on absurd.
So I actually think you raise a very good point, but I also think that there's one thing missing from your analysis, and that is that a lot of people on the left do not care about motive one way or the other. And so there is an ideological presumption that a world in which there are economic or social disparities is an unfair world, right? And so many people on the left do not regard equal opportunity as being sufficient. They're looking for equal outcomes. They're looking for statistical parity. And until that's achieved, which it will never be, they will see a world full of discrimination. When you and I hear the word discrimination, we often think of evil motives, but I think we've gone beyond that in our society, where the left sees discrimination even in the absence of illicit motivation.
Fatima Goss-Graves, do you want to weigh in here?
No, thank you.
All right, very good. I do want to thank both of our experts today. This has been an enlightening discussion with lots of questions from our audience. We may have set a record for the number of questions handled by our speakers. So thank you both for sharing your thoughts, Jennifer Becerris and Fatima Goss-Graves. To our audience, a reminder and an invitation to join us for our call tomorrow, telephone conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing the Missouri versus McNeely case. That's the Supreme Court case on the limits of a non-consensual blood draw in a traffic stop. That is tomorrow at 1 p.m. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.